Thank you for joining us. This is Clinical Conversations podcast number 136. We're part of Journal Watch, which seeks out practice-changing research for clinicians. Its website is jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Joining me is co-host Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina. Last week, The Lancet published a paper on the role of aspirin in lowering the risks of colorectal cancer and Lynch syndrome. The condition predisposes its carriers, about one person in 1,000, to colorectal and uterine cancers sometimes at an early age. Patients took 600 milligrams of aspirin daily, or placebo, for roughly 2.5 years. The first analysis, done at the end of the intervention, showed no advantage for aspirin over placebo, but follow-up some 3 years later showed a significant advantage, a reduction in relative risk by over 50%. We're joined today by Professor Sir John Byrne, the study's first author. He's a clinician and professor of clinical genetics at Newcastle University and also chair of the British Society for Human Genetics. Welcome, Sir John.
Thank you.
What made you think that there might be a delayed benefit from aspirin, and were you surprised when you found one?
I think delight rather than surprise would be a better description.
Uh-huh.
The reason that we anticipated it was that when we first designed this study back in the early 90s, there were a number of papers, particularly Giovannucci's report, which were epidemiological analyses of the association of aspirin use with protection against cancer, which suggested that it was only when people had been on aspirin for several years that there was a benefit. So we anticipated that when we did our study for a couple of years, we might not see an immediate effect, but that there might be a longer-term effect. And what we set up to do was do our initial analysis at the end of the intervention based on adenomas, which at that time were taken to be the gold standard biomarker, and then to look for cancers on a blinded 10-year follow-up program. Unfortunately, when we got to the end of the intervention, not only had we had no effect on cancer, which we anticipated, but we had absolutely no effect on adenoma formation either. And that was so dramatic that, in fact, our funding agents didn't renew our grant, but we had to sort of struggle on anyway and carry on with our blinded follow-up. And what we found at the last gasp, virtually, when the first patients reached their 10-year mark, was that at about 5 years out from starting the aspirin, there was a very clear separation, so that the people who had been treated with aspirin but had now discontinued it were getting far fewer cancers than those who were on the placebo.
Why do you think that there was this inflection point around the five-year mark?
Well, I think that it's a relatively early point compared to the recent literature that came out of the meta-analysis of all the old aspirin trials, which was published earlier this year by Peter Rothwell and colleagues. Mm-hmm. What they did was a beautiful study where they went back to the cancer registries and looked up the names of all the people, many of them doctors, in the early 80s who'd taken part in the early aspirin trials.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the people who had been on aspirin for 4 years, at about 10 years out, their incidence of cancer started to fall away from the placebo group. And in fact, they've now demonstrated that there was about a 25% drop in cancer mortality in that group. So what we've demonstrated is in some ways the cherry on the cake, because we were doing a randomized controlled trial with colon cancer as the endpoint, which was the special feature. The Women's Health Study actually included cancer in its endpoint back in the 90s, but we were the first to actually look at a genetically targeted group. Now, what's special about this group is that they get cancer very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The mean age of onset of polyps in this group is at about 42, and the mean age of onset of cancer is 45. So, and that, together with the fact that we get regular interval cancers in people on colonoscopy, tells us that you can progress very rapidly through from the first inklings of a malignant transformation into a full-blown cancer. So it's not surprising that we saw a protective effect emerging rather quicker than was suggested in the general population.
The aspirin dose in this trial was 600 milligrams a day, which
is a pretty
generous daily dose.
Yep.
Do we know anything about the risk of, and we know that GI bleeding is a dose dependent with aspirin. Do we know if there was any issue in this population about side effects?
Well, yes, we do know, because actually part of our randomized trial was to collect severe adverse event data, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
Our surprise and delight was that, in fact, there was no significant difference between the treatment and placebo groups. There were 11 GI bleeds or ulcers in the treatment group and 9 in the placebo group, which mm-hmm. is not significant. But, in fact, that's about what you'd expect in a population of fit people.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to cause about sort of 1 or maybe 2 per 1,000 patient years of treatment, you're going to cause an ulcer or severe bleed.
Sure.
Now,
so
bear
maybe
in mind,
if obviously these are not 80-year-olds. These are
exactly.
Yeah.
These are young people, fit, mean age of 45. And of course, there is also a selection process here. We had 1,009 gene carriers joined our study, but a couple of hundred of them didn't take part in the aspirin limb because they knew they were sensitive to aspirin. So many people have tried aspirin, got indigestion, and stopped taking it.
Okay.
And obviously they self-selected themselves out of the study. So we were looking at a selected population to some extent. But
yes.
Nevertheless, it's a sort of real one because, you know, in the general population, if people know that they react badly to aspirin, they'll avoid it.
They're not going to try it, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
And so how do you think this will play out? Do you think these patients will have to take aspirin at X dose for X number of years to get maximal benefit, or do you think this will more likely be a lifelong preventive therapy?
I think this is a rolling effect. I think that what we did was we treated people for 2 years, and about 5 years out, we saw the consequence of that treatment, which
uh-huh.
will last for a couple of years or so. We're still documenting that. And my prediction is that from about 8 years out, the two lines will run parallel again. So the benefit will have been lost effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it will have been an episode of benefit following an episode of treatment. I think the evidence is, if you put together what we've found, together mm-hmm. with the general literature, which is now 25 years virtually in development, in truth, this is a no-brainer. If people have got Lynch syndrome, which, remember, carries about a 50% risk of giving you cancer before retirement age,
yes.
then taking 2 aspirins a day is not a huge intervention. And indeed, just to put that in context, we have no hesitation of putting these people on 2 yearly colonoscopy from the age of 25. The death rate associated with 2 aspirin a day is probably less than the death rate associated with colonoscopy.
Right.
You know, so we just lose sight of that because we've got a little spooked by the concept of dose. When I trained as a physician back in the 70s and 80s, and back in those days when we didn't have so many anti-inflammatories, we were taught that you gave an increasing dose of aspirin for arthritis until people got tinnitus.
Yeah.
You literally gave them enough tablets to give them ringing in their ears, which is about 3 grams a day.
Mm-hmm.
So in that context, and indeed many of the early aspirin trials for heart attacks, they used up to 1,200 milligrams a day as the, you know, 4 tablets a day.
Mm-hmm.
So we deliberately went for a big dose because we could, and we could actually test that, that what would be seen as now a high dose. And now, of course, I want to do another study to keep me going until I'm absolutely too old to drink out of a cup without a spout, which will be to do 3 doses. So we're going to randomize people. And the last study was called CAP2, and
uh-huh.
after much debate, we thought we'd call the next one CAP3.
Okay.
And CAP3 will be randomizing people to either 100 milligrams, 300 milligrams, or 600 milligrams of aspirin.
Yeah.
And we're going to do that in 2 ways. For anyone who's listening and wants to sort of become part of this, you can log on to www.cap3.org,
uh-huh.
not surprisingly, or just look us up on the web,
uh-huh.
on the Google. And what we're going to do is that in a half a dozen centers, which were the central teams for the CAP2 group, where they have major registries, for example, Denmark, can identify and give you the name and address of 600-plus gene carriers who are under their care.
Yeah.
So they're obviously an ideal population for this sort of study. And what we're aiming to do in these registry populations is randomize them to a blinded aspirin dose, which we give them, and they'll take 3 tablets a day, but they won't know which ones are real and which ones aren't.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't know which dose they're on. But for people in the States and in Colombia and, you know, everywhere around the world who would like to be part of this, we thought we would do them in a slightly different way, that they can join our confidential database, and then we will randomly allocate them to one of those 3 groups.
Mm-hmm.
But then they can just go and get their own aspirin.
Yeah.
So once they've been allocated, they know you are part of the 300 milligram group, go buy an aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
And logistically, as you can imagine, that's massively simpler because, as I can testify, trying to run intervention trials in 16 countries is really quite wearing and increasingly expensive because of the regulatory controls. And, of course, the point is that this is an over-the-counter preparation you can buy in any supermarket. And the side effects have been well known for a century now. So it's not like we're doing a routine clinical trial of a new drug.
Right.
And it seems to me that we can use that free availability to our advantage and do a sort of freewheeling trial, which, you know, people will criticize. It's open label. But it's worth remembering the original trial by my hero, Richard Doll, in the physician's trial that proved that aspirin prevented heart attack was an open label trial too. So, it's, you know, open label trials have their advantages that they can be much faster moving and recruit a very much larger number of people at low cost.
But and if honestly, we run that along, placebo group because we've already established.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's ethical to have a placebo group with Lynch syndrome anymore. It works. And I, to be honest, if you had Lynch syndrome, would you take placebo?
Tomorrow. Yesterday.
You know, I mean, you know, a 60% reduction in cancer is worth getting out of bed for, you know, so you're going to take some aspirin. You know?
I will put the URL that you just referred to, Sir John, into our website, and people will both hear it. And it would be CAPP3, all one,
O-R-G.
.org. Okay, good. You know, I was going to ask you about the CAP1 follow-up that you mentioned, but I assume that you are going to follow up your earlier trial, seeing whether there was a diminution there, and that must be planned, and I'll bet you've got some data on it already, but I'm not going to ask you to share it, but you are doing that, I think, aren't you?
Well, CAP1 was our sort of first stab at this whole field. At the time, I was looking after a lot of people with familial adenomatous polyposis, the teenagers who get thousands of adenomas, and there, of course, we couldn't use cancer as an endpoint because they have prophylactic colectomy at the age of 18 to 21. Mm-hmm. So in our first trial, we were doing an adenoma prevention trial. The problem we rapidly discovered was that if you get 1,000 polyps in a teenager's colon, and even if you reduced it by 250, it's very hard to prove that. And so we had lots of video recording and estimates and counting biggest polyps and so on. It just we realized that FAP is not an easy target for this sort of work. Having said that, we did do a randomization involving a couple of hundred gene carriers back in the 90s. And in fact, that paper, interestingly, the results were marginal and not so clear. And it took us a long time to get it published, but it came out in Cancer Prevention Research this year. So we can go back on that population now and see whether any of them developed rectal cancers, which are a recognized later complication. And so there is an interesting question to ask whether we did have an impact there. Huh. But there's obviously lots of other questions emerged from this, and the obvious one, which I've already been asked about 1,000 times in the last week, is, okay, so what about me? What about the rest of us? How does this impact on our general discussion?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer there is we descend from the high ground with increasing trepidation. So up on top of the hill, people who've got Lynch syndrome, who are 45 to 50 years old, this is a no-brainer. They should be offered aspirin with all of the same provisos that we would give to someone who's just had multiple thrombotic episodes and should be on long-term aspirin. We would encourage them, if they are willing, to take part in our dose-finding study because that will help the next generation. But if they choose just to take aspirin, that's fine. If you've got a strong family history of colon cancer and say you probably belong to a Lynch family but everyone died in the past and you can't prove it, aspirin's cheap enough and easy enough to get that you could legitimately take aspirin now. If you have one first-degree relative, your cancer risk is about doubled. Now it's getting a little more marginal. If you have no family history of cancer, there are those who would say that it's not yet ready for, you know, to recommend. Having said that, there's been a lot of debate over the years about use of low-dose aspirin in the general over 50 population for heart attacks and strokes. And it's sort of a marginal debate in how much weight you give to an ulcer versus a heart attack prevented.
Mm-hmm.
Our estimate is, and we're actually doing a big international collaboration on this at the moment, but our estimate is that the effect on cancer is substantially higher than the effect on cardiovascular events in the general population.
Mm.
So that clearly changes the balance of this equation to some extent. And so a lot of people are going to look at that and say, well, okay, I can downsize my risk of cancer, heart attack, and stroke in return for a risk of an ulcer. I think that's maybe one I'll run with. Now, of course, my colleagues in gastroenterology are listening to this saying, oh, my God, they're all going to end up at our door. And that's true to some extent, because for the first 10 years or so, what we're going to see are the side effects of that advice. And then at 10 years out, you'll start to see the dip in cancer rates among the people who were the regular aspirin users. If you want to be very sophisticated, you could argue that you take aspirin in your 50s and 60s, then ditch it from then on, because that's when the side effect profile starts to become less attractive. Yet, interestingly, that's when people often prescribe it with greater abandon, so to speak, because they think that's a high-risk population.
Or you just put everyone on a H2 blocker or...
Yeah, absolutely.
I
mean, that's right. And in fact, I know in Germany, for example, it's now standard practice that everyone should be checked for Helicobacter before they start aspirin, which I think is perfectly reasonable. And everyone should have every year or 2 years have their blood count done. So I think if you did those two things, and as you say, used an H2 blocker to diminish the effects on the stomach, then, you know, you are moving into a much lower profile of side effect. The other thing just to mention is that if you take aspirin, a lot of people at the moment inevitably are saying, ah, but it causes hemorrhagic strokes. And that's true. But we need to keep that in context. It's in the same ballpark as the death rate from colonoscopy, which we never seem to mention when we're recommending people have a colonoscope. And I should say that that death rate in colonoscopy is even in the best centers, you know, that we shouldn't just attribute that to bad practice. Inevitably, occasionally, you snag a diverticulum or something and cause a perforation. By the same token, if you give someone any dose of aspirin, about 1 in 10,000 people per annum will develop a cerebral bleed, which could be devastating. Conversely, of course, once you get past about 45 to 50, you're going to significantly diminish your risk of a thrombotic stroke, which is a much higher risk. And so it isn't mentioned on the aspirin packet that there is a risk of cerebral hemorrhage, because the offset in stroke risk means it's not worth mentioning, really. So I think it tends to get overplayed. But just to put it in absolute context, I worked out the figures for Britain. If I could magically identify all the Lynch syndrome carriers, and at the moment we only know 5 to 10% of them, and put them all on 2 aspirins a day, we would probably prevent about 10,000 cancers over the next 2 to 3 decades. But we would cause about 1,000 ulcers, and we would cause about 100 hemorrhagic strokes. I can't tell you how many non-hemorrhagic strokes we'd prevent, but it would be more than 100. And we'd prevent a few heart attacks as well, because I don't know the numbers for that. So I think those are the numbers people have to be given, and then we have to leave it up to the grown-ups to decide whether they want to take the chance or not.
I was, so we didn't have to ask you, Sir John, about that same question. You answered it for us, and thank you. That was good. I was listening to your press conference last week, and you had, just to sort of tie the importance of aspirin and salicylates into the real world, and instead of treating it as if it were a magic molecule somehow, you had a theory that you put forth about mankind's increasing distance from sources of salicylates. Would you share that with our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this emerged. I made a little TV program about aspirin about 10 years ago, and I was quite interested in, and in fact, prior to that, became very interested in the whole question of where salicylate came from. And everyone probably knows that the Bayer Corporation in Germany invented aspirin back at the end of the 19th century. But what many people don't know is that the first clinical trial was carried out by the Reverend Edward Stone of Chipping Norton, who was a vicar living in South England and looking for an alternative to the cinchona bark to treat malaria, or the agues as they used to call it then, and happened upon the fact that willow bark was very bitter. And indeed, giving willow bark to his parishioners treated their symptoms. And that's where the white willow, Salix alba, gave us salicylate. And then, of course, there was 100 years of people getting terrible gastric irritation from salicylate before acetyl salicylic acid solved that problem. Now, the reason that willow is full of salicylate is that willow is exposed to lots of infections. And indeed, Edward Stone himself noticed that the willows near the river were the ones more likely to be beneficial. he attributed it to what's called the doctrine of signatures, that God puts the cures where he put the ailments. And it was sort of true, because the reason these plants produce salicylate is in order to defend themselves against infection. Because plants can't cough and they can't run away. All they can do is use what the Russians did to Napoleon, the scorched earth policy. So if you infect a plant, it dies ahead of you so that the infection can't spread. And back in the mid-90s, there was a very nice paper in Science that showed that methyl salicylate is produced by plants that grow in copses in order to warn the neighboring plants of the impending infection. So it struck me at that time that that was quite neat for two reasons. First of all, it offered us a potential mechanism for our pre-malignant protection. It may be that, in fact, salicylates are inducing programmed cell death in aberrant stem cells in the gut and elsewhere, in the same way that an infected cell triggers an apoptotic response through salicylate in plants. But the other interesting thought that, in fact, we wrote down as a theory back in 1998 in the Proceedings of Nutrition Society was that, in fact, salicylate has disappeared from the human diet. If you measure salicylates in people eating even organic food, there is virtually none in their urine because we grow plants now and protect them from all infections. Mm-hmm. So we inadvertently, in producing those wonderful green plants without any spots on the leaves, diminished the salicylate level in our natural diet. So it did make me wonder whether, in fact, the low-grade salicins and salicylate products that would be present in our primitive diet might have been beneficial to us, and that effectively the taking a low-dose aspirin is replacing an essential nutrient. Now, that might be a complete cock-and-bull story, but at least it gives us an insight into the fact that salicylate has many different effects on the body. There are maybe at least a dozen different pathways where aspirin has a major part to play. We tend to get very hung up on the inflammatory pathway, but that's not the only part of the story. So it could be that that background story gives us an insight into the mechanism.
Ah. Well, I'm going to start eating all the brown lettuce that I find in my refrigerator.
Absolutely.
It just got spots on it.
That's right.
Well, when I was a kid, you weren't allowed to leave things on your plate just because they had spots on them, you see. So I think I probably got early protection.
So John, this has been very interesting. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
That was our 136th edition. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Isidore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Schurer, thank you for listening.